feel like I just grew. I wish. My name is Sharon Barker, and I'm an alcoholic. And because I want to fit in, and I've never done this before, because of the gift of the fellowship and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a God that loves me on most days more than I love myself, I have been sober since August 20th, 1975. And for that, I'm grateful. I just like to fit in. And I'm glad you psychically called me in my sleep and told me to wear red, so I'm feeling a part of. It's like homecoming for me. I mean, I got a flower. I never was the homecoming queen, but I had a few queen friends in my days in New Orleans, but it's really been a wonderful weekend for me, and I'm sure for all of you. The speakers have just loved my heart, as I'm sure they have yours. And Mary is just one of my, I always wanted to be like her when I grew up, and it's just real special to spend time with her. And Johnny and his wife are just, I had never heard her story before, and I was very touched by what you Al-Anons go through. We probably weren't very much fun to live with, and as you heard Johnny tell you, but and he's such a gentle, kind man. And Dick and Peggy, they've become some of my favorite people over the last 4 or 5 years. And you guys are real lucky to have them here with you in the Midwest. And their sense of humor just keeps me going. And I'd like to thank Doug and Phil for inviting me here, because it's been real special for me. I grew up in Mount Vernon, Iowa, so my parents got to come and spend some time with you on Friday and Saturday, and I want to thank you for welcoming them. Because you see, I'm going to go, oh God, we're going to start now. I love my mother and father, and I am proud of them, and they are proud of me, and to bring them and share them and have you share your love and fellowship with them this weekend and make them feel so special. But another reason that I saw this weekend why I love Alcoholics Anonymous so much, and what makes it up, which is the language of the heart. And they felt that. I know they couldn't stay today, oh well, but they had to go work at a pancake breakfast, and because they're a part of the community. And there's some special people here from my hometown and Cedar Rapids and Minneapolis, and we are so lucky. I read yesterday in the Daily Reflections book that if sobriety is God's gift to me, then my sober living, my sober life, is my gift back to God. And I hope he is as pleased with my gift back to him as I am with his to me. And that sums it up for me, because it's a gift. And how I live my life is up to what I do with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and how I act on every day, a day at a time, and how I am able to give it back and be a privilege to have that in my life. I did grow up in Iowa, as you know, and that was my first resentment. I had a few, yeah, there were a few people identifying with me, but I always felt different. I come from a very normal family, as many of you met my parents this weekend, and I have two normal sisters and a normal brother, and they're all very successful and happy, and they just seem to get it. And I was always waiting for the mothership to land and take me home. And I just knew I was meant to be born to a castle somewhere, and my mind was out to get me from an early age, and it was always very loud, and there were always many people living up there, and I just dealt with it the best I knew how. And when I discovered alcohol the summer of my 14th birthday, I had something change. Something changed within me. I found something that worked for me. I was out on a country road, sitting on a country car with the football players and some of the bad girls. I was the youngest one there, and I just happened to end up with them that night, and they were passing around some Schlitz beer and some Canadian Club. And I took a swig of the Canadian Club right from the bottle and chased it with the Schlitz beer, just like you're supposed to. And I remember having something happen. I got warm all over. My toes started to warm up and tingle. Then the chest fairy visited me briefly. I stood up straight, and I was right there with all of them that had already reached puberty. And I could talk to them, and I could be funny, and I could do things I couldn't, you know, I just didn't do before. And I came alive. Alcohol made me happen. And now, it wasn't easy to go out and get right away. This was before it became a beer and wine in the grocery store, so it was a little tough to get. But I managed to get it when I wanted it, and to get drunk when I wanted to get drunk. And through my high school years, I got into a little bit of trouble, but I was such an overachiever. I was such just an overachiever at everything I did that it was overlooked a little bit, and it wasn't really noticeable. When I went off to college, it really started to happen because now I had absolutely no restrictions on my life. And it was the late 60s, and if any of you were there and remember being there, you would maybe remember that the time was kind of a confusing time for this country, and it was a confusing time for me. And I fit in because I began to get very confused. And I started to smoke some recreational marijuana, and I started to take some diet pills, which I liked to study, you know, but I liked to keep going. I mean, life is either a daring adventure or it's nothing, and I just started to go for it. And I went to the 1968 Democratic Convention to campaign for the peace candidate, and I had my sorority clothes on, and I was with my sorority sisters, and I was campaigning next to Paul Newman, and I was with those kind of people. And by the end of that weekend, I had had some sort of a psychic upheaval. I ended up with Dick Gregory marching to Mayor Daley's house to tell him what we thought, you know, and I had the bottle of wine in one hand and the joint in the other hand, and, you know, I was in my bell bottoms and the peace sign in one hand and the finger in the other, the one finger in the other, you know. And I started to feel good. I mean, I started to feel like I fit in with all of this confusion, and because I just, you know, I was on a path at one time in my life, and it just took a left turn somewhere. And the alcohol and the drugs kept me there for a long time, and it was a downward spiral in my life. And I started to get kind of strange in college, and I think my parents noticed it when I had a suicide attempt. I had dropped out of the sorority. I had, you know, moved in with some of the rather radicals, whatever they were, and we were taking all these radical history classes, black history, and we were just strange. And my father came to visit me after I wrote him this letter on the suicide attempt, and I know I wrote in there that I was in pain, and I know I wrote in there somehow I tried to reach out and say, help me. And I didn't know what was wrong with me. And he came down to the school to talk to me with the family priest, and the priest and I got drunk that night. And I remember my father just kind of looking at both of us, and we've got a good buzz going, and we're talking about the war and politics and love, and, you know, we're hugging each other at the end of the night. We're best friends, me and this priest, and we were smashed, and they sent me to a psychiatrist, and I had many people sent me to psychiatrists, but I don't talk to them. I sit and just wait for them to figure me out. And so what happened during this time of my life is my parents, especially my father, took an interest, and I didn't hear him because, see, I have a disease of perception and selective hearing. And what I heard people say to me was not, God, we love you, we want to help you. What is wrong with you? Can't we do something? But I heard them say, what is wrong with you? Why do you have to act this way? Why can't you be like this one? Don't you know you're not enough? That's what I heard. It wasn't the truth, because I don't know truth until I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I get rid of my crap to get to the truth. But I went to New York City to work, and I started to run. I got very strange in New York City. I worked in an advertising agency where they drank a lot. I was of drinking age, and so I could drink in the bars. And I ended up staying up all night and taking a lot of psychedelics looking for truth. I would find truth in Central Park at 4 in the morning, and he played the flute, you know. Then I would take some crystal methadrine and get up and put my work clothes on and ride the subways and go down to the Pan Am building and go to work and drink again and drink all day long and then do it all over again. And I got strange is what happened. I got very paranoid. I started having anxiety attacks, and I knew I was close to the edge. And I called my father and asked me if I could go back to college, please. And he gave me another chance. And I went back to college, and I was going to take these art courses because that's what I had majored in. I had some talent. I was told that I had some talent in that area, and I did have some talent. But when I came back that semester and I took those art classes, there was no more talent. There was no more inspiration. That was dead. And I was in a depression about it. I was sad about that. I didn't talk to anybody about that. I didn't understand it. I didn't know that I was starting to allow my alcoholism to take things away in my life. And that was taken away. And I wasn't very successful in college, and I wasn't very successful with the relationship with my parents. And I drug my father through a lot that semester and told him how I felt about things and told him what I was doing. And, you know, we all have a rebel cry, and mine was, I'm not hurting anybody but myself, you know, and that's a bunch of crap when you start working the steps. So if you're thinking about that, just keep working the steps. And my dad put my steps on the bag, and he just said, that's it. I don't know what to do for you anymore. And I took my bags, and I went to Colorado to be a cowboy because, I don't know, maybe I just read a Western novel or something. But it seemed the thing to do. And I was in Colorado for a little while enjoying myself and behaving myself and not taking too many husbands home and that kind of thing. And take that off the tape. And I met Bob Dylan. He walked in the restaurant I was working in. I mean, it was him. And that was the summer he was gone or not around, you know, and I mean, he's out there researching. And so I ended up in the car with this man coming to California, and I really don't know who he was. I really have no idea. It could have been him. I'm not sure. But in Laguna Beach, we separated, and I ended up in a commune in Huntington Beach where I came with $2. I left with $4 and a dog. I made a profit. I stayed 4 months. I had a great time. We drank wine, and we smoked pot. And we were poor and on welfare, but we were happy and serene all the time. And, I mean, you put the seeds in the crunchy granola. You didn't throw anything away. It was just the way we lived, and then the animals were stoned, and the people were stoned, and but I was okay, I was taken care of, and I came back to Colorado, and they were living in my place, and I had no self-worth to even take my things off the wall or pack up my things. There was a box that I had not unpacked when I moved there, and that's the only thing I took with me. And when I walked away from that apartment, that cabin, I thought, why don't you go get your things? What is wrong with you? Why don't you ask the people living there using your things for your things back? They belong to you. And I didn't have enough self-worth to turn around and walk back in and do that. And I thought, what is wrong with you? I was 21 years old. I ended up living with my mother and father. My mother said I could stay at the house as long as I didn't take any drugs. And I didn't get into my father's way because it was still very, very tense with me and him. And so I didn't. I just smoked some of the pot that is non-recreational pot, and I drank alcohol because it was acceptable. And I was in those taverns every night drinking alcohol, sitting with the losers and judging them as being the losers. And I knew they'd be the losers, you know. And I'm in there every night with them, drinking, being a loser. And my dog was killed that year. I started to get very, very sick. I went to one of the doctors in town, and he gave me Valium for my nerves. And so I started to take the Valium. And nobody knows it, but I'm beginning to suffer from the physical effects of the disease of alcoholism. Because when I finally moved away and met my new guru, he took me to an organic farm. He was organic, and he thought that would save me and help me. And he took me to northern Wisconsin to a farm. And I was still sick and very bloated and very toxic, and they didn't know it was well. They took me to a doctor, and they found this non-functional gallbladder, and they found pancreatitis. And the doctor asked me if I abused alcohol or drugs, and I looked at him with every bit of sincerity, and I said, I'm organic. I am not abusing alcohol and drugs. And so they took out this gallbladder. I started to feel better, and I started to have the organic way of life. If you don't know it, don't worry about it. It's a lot of work. I thought I wanted this, and Phil Phil gave me organic pot to smoke because he took away my alcohol and he took away my cigarettes, and that was the way we lived. We named our farm, we went and shopped at the co-op in Minneapolis, and we would buy this bulk food and we'd put it in the pickup and drive home, and you know, all these wheat berries that I would grind up and make bread with. And I mean, I knew. I'd look at all this food and I thought, I'm not going to stay long enough to eat this. I mean, I just knew that. And we had this, we had organic sheep, we had organic cat and dog and horse, and he wasn't allowing me to drink my alcohol. He occasionally gave me some organic dandelion wine, which were little tiny bottles we had made, and it was just enough to just wet your whistle. Man, that makes me thirsty thinking about it right now. But I want to tell you about the second snowfall of the winter because I want to tell you how important alcohol had become to me. We were getting snowed in again, and the first time we were snowed in, we were really snowed in for about 3 days. And it was starting to really snow heavily that night, and I was in my rocking chair reading Mother Earth News or something, and we didn't have a TV. And Phil was over there with his banjo in the corner with phonograph with his How to Play the Banjo with Pete Seeger record. And he had a 5-string and he wasn't ever very good at playing it. And that night it seemed to just kind of grate on my nerves every time he'd miss a note. And I noticed that he would pick it up and start the record over again. And I'm rolling in this chair. I'm really rocking, you know. I'm smoking this pot and it's just not, you know, it's not doing it. And the dog is just, you know, it's got this look on his face, like panic, and then the cat's tail's going, you know, and the snow is starting to look really heavy. And I jumped in the car, and I went into a one-horse town, and they had a general store, and they had 2 cheap gallons of wine, and I bought it, and I came home, and I put the wine on the table. And he took a look at the wine and took a look at me, and he had seen me in those taverns in my hometown, you know, maudlin and drunk or rowdy with my boots kicked up, and you know, throwing my pool cue around or something. And he didn't like me like that. So he knew what was going to come. And he went to bed. And I'll tell you, after a couple glasses of that wine, the cat was smiling. You know, the dog was happy. And I felt relief. I felt relief. And I just kept going through those bottles of wine. And about, I don't know, in the middle of the night when he woke up and I'm having my party alone with the cat and the dog and we're having a good time. And he stood at the door and he gave me that look again. That look that I had seen on people's face who loved me and cared about me, but I didn't know that's what that look was. I thought that look was disappointment and disgust and repulsion. And he gave me that look, and my head said loud and clear, alcohol is more fun than you, Phil. And I made a decision that night based on my head, based on my disease, and I gave that up. I gave up that organic living. I started to get drunk when I could. We didn't have a lot of money, but when I could, I got drunk. And it took me till next spring to drive him away. He was really stubborn. But I got blackballed by the organic community, and that was fine because I was alone. And I was alone with our garden, which was a half acre of marijuana back in the woods. And so that's what I did. I tended the pot, and I got drunk when I could. And I had my friend Clarence the farmer would come bring the booze, and he'd be on his tractor, and I'd feel better as soon as I could see him coming up the lane. And the reason he was on his tractor is because he had too many DWIs, and he was driving a tractor. I guess Clarence's wife went to Allen and I took away the keys because he stopped coming, and then I was really all alone. And I was drinking and eating this pot and harvesting this pot and just alone with it. And I harvested this stuff. It was August, and it was time that winter was coming. It was a snap in the air. I was going to turn it all over, make this money, and get out of town. I didn't know where I was going. I just knew it was time to go. And I went to turn my dope deal over to you know, sell it and make this money, and I forgot the dope. I had driven 45 miles into town, and I left it back on the farm in hefty bags. So I joined the carnival that night because it was in town. Now, when I said maybe your best thinking got you here, I thought about that for a while. It wasn't really a thought-out decision other than my head said, I want to be a gypsy. So I joined the carnival. I became a shooting gallery girl with Matt Armstrong shows, Maggie, and I started to let my alcoholism flourish because that's the way they lived, and that's what I found anyway. And I remember calling my mother somewhere in the South, and she had to go back and attend to that the animals that were there, the furniture that was in that house, and. She had to take care of all of that. I just left. That's what I do. I just leave. I don't know. I take me with me. I don't know that I am pounds heavier when I leave situations like that, that the baggage has gotten heavier. I don't know that, because I'm on the run, and alcohol is still working for me. I ended up being greeted at the door of my motel room in Bogalusa, Louisiana, with some shotguns one morning, and some of Franklinton Parish's finest down in that nice parish of Louisiana happened to find out that I had some drugs in my room, and just happened to find out that, I mean, they just happened to know where they were. And they found everything, and they stuck me in maximum security for 31 days. And my new boyfriend, of course, he was with me. That's where you find him, is with the carnival. His skunk and my dog went to jail. We all went to jail, his pet skunk and my dog. And I thought, now what is a nice girl like me doing in a place like this? This was not in the chapter of the book I was writing. My dad flew down to help me. He hired an attorney for me. And I had to ask him about this because it's like it's such another person. I went to see him, and he was at the attorney's. And, you know, there I sit, a foot away from him, in these chairs, looking across the desk at this attorney, and I'm in handcuffs. And I know it hurt him deeply to see me in that situation, and I couldn't look at him. And I felt like I wanted to just crawl under the nearest rock that day. And he flew home, and they let me out when they wanted to let me out. And they let me out, as I said, 31 days later, and I found New Orleans. And if you're a good alcoholic, you can sniff your way right to that French Quarter, and I did. I danced for a while, but when you're starting to bloat in your alcoholism, and you wear fishnet stockings as part of the costume, Mary probably knows about those, and they put these props up on the wall with staple guns, you know, and they look nice from a distance, but they're very tacky, actually. And I would go out there and I would pose, but I would be so drunk on kvassia that the bartender would see me, that I would get these fishnet stockings stuck on the palm tree on the wall. And sometimes I could kind of loosen it off and, you know, maybe just make a little hole and get it off and just go about my dance. And sometimes I wouldn't. And sometimes I would just, I remember when the Alabama football team was there, and I just ripped these fishnets away because they're waiting for my dance. There's only so much you can slink around and do. You know, it's my big solo, and as I ripped this fishnet away, all this toxic alcohol-loaded mess came pouring through the fishnet, and, you know, I had a new part there. And I was humiliated, but I continued my dance, and I went and had more kvassia and just let it work tonight and let those feelings shut off, and I began to live a very alcoholic life. I began to, this gentleman that I had, this guy with the carnival, lived with me for 2 years down there in the French Quarter, and we weren't kind to one another, I guess is a nice way to say it, and we would have these alcoholic fights, and we lived above a biker bar, and they would call the cops on us because we were just too, they didn't want to come upstairs, and my mom and dad had to go to Texas to see somebody, and they thought they'd come over and find me, and they found me, and they found me living in this tar paper roof type apartment with this guy who called me four-letter words in front of my mother and put the pet snake in my dad's face as soon as he met him. And I think I had a new black eye I was trying to cover up that day. And I remember they tried to take us out to eat, and my mother had tears in her eyes, and all my dad could do was I watched his jaw flinch a lot, and when they left that day to go back to Iowa, I wanted to go with them, and I really think they were going to say, come with us, you know, but I think we all knew nothing would change. It was the despair of the disease of alcoholism, but nobody knew alcoholism. Absolutely nobody thought that was my problem. Neither did I. I just felt bad. And continued the next couple of years to drink very alcoholically and to have things happen to me that I don't ever want to forget because I don't ever want to repeat it. To have 2 and 3 day blackouts and be in situations and come to in situations and just hope the next drink takes me back into that blackout because I don't want to remember. And I worked seedier and seedier bars. I became a bartender and I started to get in violent situations where I didn't think that this, I just thought that the next, you know, the next violent act might be it for me. And my friend Michael was shot and killed on Mardi Gras Day by the police because he had a gun, and he pointed it, he leveled it at the policeman who shot him, and the policeman who shot him knew him. He was a bouncer at Pat O'Brien's, but he was in an alcoholic blackout. That's the only thing I can think of what happened. And we were together that day, and I kept telling him, put away the gun. Oh, come on, Michael, put away the gun. I had no reality of what was going on. And I walked over his body that day. I was 2 feet inside the door when the policeman shot him. And a speaker named Norm Alpe talks about seconds and inches. And I saw the tape over there. It's called Seconds and Inches. I used to hear Norm speak a lot when I was new. And God, he fired me up. He'd give me the courage to go out there and stay sober for a week. And he used to talk about seconds and inches that we get to be in this room this morning and sit here and have the gift. And I knew what he meant because that day it was seconds and inches. And I went to New York with my sister and I had a nervous breakdown. I sat in a room and I drank and I read books and I couldn't leave. And I ended up coming to California with some people writing a book. And I always found somebody doing something, and they were trying to teach me to drink coming all the way across the country because I was in and out of blackouts. They left me in Maryland because I was just maudlin. And they felt bad and came back and got me. I was standing on the street with my bags. I had absolutely nowhere to go, and these two alcoholics were leaving this alcoholic in Maryland. And we found Barney's Beanery in Southern California, and I fell in love again. It was just a seedy, tacky bar in West Hollywood with heavy drinkers and crazy people, and I couldn't get a job. I was unemployable. They hired me for 10 minutes as a cocktail waitress, and they asked me to leave. I'm 170 pounds of Mama Share. That's what they called me, was Mama Share. I'm in and out of blackouts. I'm sitting in the bar, and I'm drunk. I'm drunk with my body, but my mind is telling me what a loser I am, and I can't get enough alcohol to my head to just make it work one more night. You know, that Jose Cuervo gold used to work for me, and now it wasn't working for me anymore. And I went back to New Orleans, and I couldn't get my old job back on Lower Decatur Street. They had asked me to leave. It was one of those bars you could smell walking down the street. I had gotten fired for having a bad attitude. I wouldn't dance with these guys, and I became unemployable. People, when I walked down the street, walked away from me. I came back to California on my way to Hawaii, on the run. And I ended up at Barney's Beanery, and this guy sobered up, I guess, with me and realized what he had, and he went to Hawaii and left me there. And I thought, what the hell am I doing in this place again? They closed the bars at, I don't know, 3 in the morning or 2 in the morning or something, and I didn't want to live in a town that closed the bars because I had to drink all the time. It didn't matter whether it worked for me or not. I just had to drink. I remember being in Florida on the 4th of July, and they were buying me drinks at this officer's club, like, they were lined up. I could have sat there for an hour and kept drinking these shots of tequila. But I had to go into the bathroom and lock the door and take the quart from my purse and hit on it because I just couldn't get enough. And that's the way I was drinking my alcohol. I was asked to go to Palm Springs one night, and I like Harley Davidson's, and I had never been to Palm Springs, so these guys called me out of the bar, and they asked me to go with them. And I hadn't been asked anywhere in a while, so I was happy to do it. And I found out later why they asked me was because it was windy going through the desert that night and they needed a little extra weight on the back tire. So they asked the fat one out and I sat on the back of that bike and we got into Palm Springs and they left me at some nightclub and they went on. And I met two new people. I mean, I'm not one for partying alone, really. And I met the bar boys and after they got off, they took me somewhere. And I don't remember much of the evening other than when I came to and I was in a violent situation that was really happening. This was not a DT. I had violent DTs where people were hurting me all the time, but this was happening to me. They were kicking me in the face with their boots, and they were beating me up, and I couldn't get out of this one. And I was screaming. I remember screaming for help, and at some point, I thought, what's the use? My spirit just died, and I stopped screaming. They broke my jaw in 3 places and raped me and drugged me around and beat me up so badly that when the police did find me the next day, they thought I was not a Caucasian. I had so many bruises over all my body. And they took me out of town, rolled me off the side of the road, and left me there face down in the sand. July 27th, 1975 in the desert. Should have bled to death. I was bleeding from my broken jaw and from my broken nose. Should have just laid there, baked. But I heard something inside of me. There was a something that said, get up, I want to live. Get up, I want to live. I don't know what you call it. I call it my God. And I did get up, and I did go down this blacktop road, and I did find, I guess, a lawn chair by a pool, a condominium something. And I laid there and passed out, and the gardener found this beached hole of a mess about 6:30 in the morning, called the police, and the police came, and the ambulance came, and they rushed me into the hospital, and I finally became what I wanted to be. I finally arrived. I was finally, my name was there after the word victim. That's what I've been working for. Because you see, Mary talked about it. It was your fault that what was going on in my life was happening to me. I blamed you. I blamed situations. I never knew about taking responsibility for my own actions. And that day, as they were taking me into surgery, I heard that voice again, that truth voice. And I am incapable of being honest with myself without the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Absolutely incapable. I've got to keep that channel clean to know truth, I'll tell you. And I didn't know truth that day, but that voice was loud, and that voice said, you know what? It's not your father's fault that you're lying here on this gurney today. It's not those guys. They didn't do this to you. It's not that Catholic church. It's not George who broke your heart at 18. Your sister, the Mensa, who set the standards for the family. It's not their fault. You did this to you. I didn't want to hear that. I don't know what to do with that, but I heard it. And it was all a setup, getting me ready for Alcoholics Anonymous. I laid in the hospital for 2 weeks. Nobody sent me an airline ticket for the first time in my life. Nobody came and said, let's go start over in Arizona, Sharon. Nobody did that. I was alone. I was finally with myself and with my disease, and I didn't know. But the beautiful thing was all of this was getting me ready for Alcoholics Anonymous. A guy that I met in the bar, Barney's Beaner, said I could come stay with him, and I went and I stayed with him. And he lived above a liquor store in West Los Angeles, and that was fine. Said I was on a liquid diet, and I had all these wires all over my face, and he'd buy me a gallon of red wine every day before I went to work. And I'd stick a straw on the top of the red wine, and I'd stick a straw through the wires in my face where the tooth had been, and I'd suck on the red wine. And I didn't like alcohol anymore. Something had happened. I didn't care for the taste of it. It wasn't doing its magic anymore, but I drank it anyway because I didn't want to have those funny things happen to me. I just sat there and drank it like Kool-Aid. Sipped on it all day long. He came home one night and said that I had to leave, and so the next day I called my mother. Now, I am a mother today, and I can't even imagine the pain I put my mother through, because she got a panic phone call that her daughter had been beaten up and this kind of thing, and she didn't know what hospital I was in or what city I was in. And 2 days later, my sister in New York found me and then told my mother that I was okay and was going to make it. And so for 2 days, my mother didn't know if her number two daughter was going to make it or what kind of shape she was in. And when I called her that day, she said to me, words that I've asked her, I said, where did you get those words? And she said, I don't know. And what she said to me hit me in the gut like somebody just kicked me. She said, Sharon, I can't help you anymore. Why don't you go to the Salvation Army? God, the gratitude is just overwhelming me. If she would have sent me $20 more, you'd have another speaker here this weekend. She cut me off. And I did the next thing. And the next thing was a phone number laying there. A girl I met at that bar who was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't know it. But see, I have a loving God, and so do you, because we're here today. And I called Chris, and I said, Chris, I have nowhere to go, I have nothing to do. And she said, Sharon, I can't help you, but Suzanne can. And Chris wasn't sober that day, that's why. And she was smart enough to finally recognize my disease. She finally recognized my disease. Somebody did, thank God. And I called Suzanne and said, I didn't know I was calling a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I just knew this girl would help me, and I was in a panic, and I had to go back to court, and I had to go back. All this mess and these doctors, and I was tired. I was so tired. And I called Chris, and Chris told me to call Suzanne, and I called Suzanne, and Suzanne read my mail right away.
you know, a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous, sober 5 years, and in that evangeling stage, you know, she was like really into it, and she sent two of her babies over to get me, and she said, just don't drink anything, don't smoke anything, and sit on the steps, and we'll come get you. It's like, okay, I really had no other options. And I sat on the steps of that liquor store, and this Volkswagen pulled up, and these two bright-eyed, cheery girls popped out, and I just thought, no, People like that don't associate with me, you know. I don't associate with people like that, but I knew better. And they put me in the back of this Volkswagen, and they were so happy to have me, I didn't understand. And they talked about themselves all the way to the meeting. I kind of thought they were a little selfish. I thought they should ask me about me. And I had this newspaper clipping in my pocket about, you know, the Palm Springs Herald or whatever it is, about this thing that had happened to this woman. And in case they asked me about what happened to me. But they didn't. And they took me into a meeting, and a man with a tie, a man stood by the door, and he was kind to me, and he said, welcome. Do you know how soft those words were for me? Welcome. And I came in, and I sit in the front because that's where they put me. And they raised my hand for me. I didn't know how they knew I was new. I had no idea. And without me even being conscious of it, the hope started to happen. I passed the 20 questions with 17 and made somebody happy. I don't remember anything about the meeting other than the speaker saying that he always waited for the mothership to land to say, you can come home now, Bill. And that was identification for me, because I knew he knew how I felt. And they took me away, and they said, okay, now don't drink and use anything. We'll pick you up tomorrow night. And they would sit and talk to me in the car, because their sponsors had said, wait for the lights of the liquor store to shut off before you send her upstairs. And that's love. That's love. And they did that. And then they moved me out about a week later, because they knew I had to get out, and they moved me out, and they gave me the sleeping bag. And I was assigned to various people's floors for a week at a time, and I didn't know it was for a week at a time. And I just kind of get moved in, and then I get rejected at the end of the week. And I was so rummy around here. I was also wired up the first 3 months I was here. I couldn't talk, which was just beautiful because I had to learn to listen. I had to learn to listen. And I started to hear things like, it's a day at a time. And I thought, God, you know, I danced with the Krishnas. I hung with the Jesus freaks. I was almost baptized by the Pentecostals. The Scientologists wanted me. But all they did, all that stuff for eternity, you know. And I ran when they said forever. I ran. And here in Alcoholics Anonymous, she said, no, it's a day at a time. I thought, you know, I can do that. I know how to live a day at a time. And somebody asked me for a ride to a meeting one night, and I'm still in my wired stage, and I remember saying, but it's a day at a time. I can't take a ride tomorrow night. That's tomorrow. I'll tell you tomorrow. And I was absolutely so confused about these simple sayings, and an old-timer took me aside and showed me his calendar and showed me all of the plans he had. And then he asked me how I was. And you better be real good if you got a rummy newcomer and ask her how she is. Better be patient. Because what happened was, when he asked me that question, I remember standing there a long time. And I had that Rolodex brain that just, you'd spin it, you know, and it'd just go around. All those cards would flap by, and I just have to wait for it to land on a word, you know? And it would always land on the same word. Fine. So I told him through my wired mouth, I was fine. And he said, well, that's what we're talking about. Emotionally, you're okay right now, aren't you? You feel safe and you feel okay. Yeah. But it's okay to make plans. You can get a ride to tomorrow night's meeting. And God, that was a kind thing for him to do, to explain that to me. And I couldn't work for the first 3 months. I went to a lot of meetings. I was drugged around by a woman named June Ann, who, I don't know if she's sober today, but she was real good to me. And she drugged me to the architects' meeting, and they were crazy there. And she drugged me to Alano clubs during the day. And I remember one had a fish tank, and all I could do was sit there and watch the fish all day long. And then one of the fish died, and I was very upset about that. But I would go to the meeting at night, and I had absolutely nothing going for me, but these people would pick me up and take me, and they loved me. And they said, it's going to be all right, kid. And John was talking about that last night, and that's when they did that and patted me on the back, I felt something happen. I knew you knew how I felt. And my cry was, although you don't understand. And I finally found my family of understanding. It happened here. I got a sponsor because a guy with a Texas accent and a tattooed tear kept sticking his finger in my chest and telling me to get a sponsor, I'll get drunk. And I didn't like Michael, I didn't like his tattooed chair, I didn't like his skinny body, and I didn't like his Texas accent, I didn't like anything about him. So I thought, I'm going to get a sponsor so he will just lay off me. I don't want him touching me anymore. So I went home and I went through all his phone numbers that were crumpled up, you know, and I found one that had written her name and wrote something else other than her name. That's the only reason I picked my first sponsor. That was it. Because she took the time to write something under her name. And so I called her up and I asked her to be my sponsor, and she said, okay. She said, the first thing I want you to do is get your sleeping bag and come over and live on my couch for a while. And I'll tell you, as soon as I got a sponsor, my life changed. Immediately. You know, I went from a floor to a couch like that. That made an impression on me. That made an impression on me. And they had given me this book, and I had given them my last quarter for this book, and I paid them off, too. Every time I got a little change from some kindly old-timer to buy cigarettes, I would slink up to them and ask them if I could have a bus ticket back to New Orleans to get my clothes, and they'd laugh at me and give me change and say, call your sponsor, kid, whatever. So I had this change. I kept paying off this big book like every other week, and I finally paid it off because you're not going to give me anything. You know? I didn't want to owe you anything. You know, I'm a scorekeeper. You know? And in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're a scorekeeper, you better learn to stop being a scorekeeper. Because if you give, you get back tenfold. It's really true. And I am overpaid. Overpaid. But she moved me to her couch, and life started to change for me. I took the wires off, and she made me read 3 pages of that book a night. She made me get on my knees and say a little gratitude prayer at night. She made me ask God in the morning to keep me safe, sane, and sober, and that's what I had to do if I lived in her house. And I felt like I prayed to that sleeping bag for a long time. I had no feelings about it for a long time. But I did it because she asked me. And it's been said here this weekend that you can't think your way into good living. You have to act your way into good living and good thinking. And that's what I was taught early on, is how to act my way into it. Because if I sat around and waited to feel it, I'd still be sitting and waiting. I have learned how to act my way into this good life. The steps are action-oriented. You can't sit there and read them and have the spiritual awakening. You have to do them. You have to work them. It doesn't say take them. It says how it worked. And she had me start. And we had to go get a job because the wires came off, the court thing was over. We had to kind of settle in, and I kind of started to give up the idea of going back to New Orleans and get those clothes, you know. I started to just go, okay, I'm here for a while. As soon as I feel better, maybe I'll go back. And I got a job as a waitress, and I just didn't like it, and I didn't do well. And if you have a bad attitude out there at your job, it's not a fun day. And especially if you're a waitress and you rely on tips to live. They would ask me, people would ask me, good morning, how are you? And I'd tell them, you know, and they didn't really care. They just wanted a nice hot breakfast and some hot coffee. They didn't want to hear my tirade, you know, and I was angry. And they asked me one night how I was doing and how it was going, and I said, it's crap. You know, this waitress work is crap. And they said, well, you better change your attitude. And I said, but it's an honest program. And they said, no, Sharon. In here, you come and you tell us the truth. Out there, they're paying you to work. They're not paying you to think. They're not paying you to talk. They're paying you to work. So I learned a valuable lesson, and I learned the Al-Anon smile, and I went out there, and I tried it on them, and my tips got better. You know? I learned how to become a worker among workers. And I have left jobs now with sick pay that they give me when I leave. I have left jobs with a going-away party and wishing me well today. It's amazing. It is absolutely amazing. I am... got emotionally involved in my first year because he was an old-timer. He had 6 more months than me, and he had all the answers. He had done his 4th and 5th step, and I got to read it, you know. And should have been some clues in that one, but there wasn't. And we fell in love, and we courted one another, and he read me poetry and bought me flowers, and He'd be the coffee man, I'd be the cookie girl, and we just had an Alcoholics Anonymous relationship for a long time. And about 11 months, I got a little crazy. You know, I had done my first 3 steps with my sponsor, but I had balked at that 4th step. There were things I wanted to take to the grave with me, and she was on me to write it. I was coming up on my year, and in my group, there's a lot of peer pressure. You do your 4th and 5th step before you're a year sober, or the peers get on you. There was a woman, Pat, she had 8 days less than me. And they would read, you know, she had done her inventory when she was like 5 months sober or something, 6 months sober. And I remember after she came in 8 days after me, and the old timers started to pay a lot of attention to her and took all of it away from me. I didn't care for Pat very much. and she had done her 4th and 5th step early, you know, and seemingly was doing pretty okay. But it seemed like every time they'd read it and I'd be sitting near her, you know, and they'd get to steps 4 and 5, she'd turn at me with those little thin blue lips and give me a smile. And she'd make me mad. She'd make me mad. And about 11 months of sobriety, I thought I'd better go have my slip because it was time. And I started to hear people talk about having their slip, and I'm glad I had my slip, and I started tracking on slip. I'm not talking to my sponsor very much, and I'm not telling the truth to her, and I'm setting myself up for my slip because if once I'm here a year, I'm committed. So I better go have my slip. And I just happened to get a credit card in the mail, and I just happened to find myself at the airport one night. And I called Janet, and I hadn't talked to her in a while. And she was kind of an honest sponsor. She was definitely louder than my own head. And when I called her that night, she said, "Fine, Sharon, go have your slip." I was telling her goodbye, and I'd be back. "Go ahead. Go have your slip. It'll be like my friend Stella, who was 11 months sober and wouldn't finish her inventory either." And she went out and had her slip, and she burned up in a bed. Well, you know, kind of takes a damper off your little trip and puts a damper on it. And she made me mad. And I hung up that phone, you know, and I found myself buying a notebook and in the coffee shop, you know, and I found myself thinking things like, you know, I was just angry. I was so angry at her that I just started to write, and what happened was I overcame the fear with my anger. The anger got me through the fear. And today I have enough faith that it takes over with the fear. The faith is stronger than the fear on most days today because of my experience of being sober 15 years. Because I know it's just a hallway and I'm going to get through the next door and I'm going to be okay. But then I didn't know that, and the anger motivated me. And I thought if I go out and slip, then I'll have less time than Pat. You know, and I just, whatever it took for me to do that. And I did my 5th step with her, and I didn't plot her death. My sponsors did, because she shared back with me her secrets. And I didn't feel so alone anymore. When I took my 1st birthday cake, I felt more committed to Alcoholics Anonymous than I had ever felt. I felt like I deserved to be here. I had absolutely none, no self-worth when I got here. None. And the inventory had given me just a little, enough to feel. And it started to fill that hole, started to fill up with working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, began to work on my inside. I was always one of those outside, fix it from the outside in. And I didn't know that the doorknob is on the inside. And I have to crack it open and let you see me a little bit and start to fill it up from the inside. I didn't know that. I got married in my 2nd year of sobriety to Al, and we got married by a Baptist minister. We were both ex-Catholics at the time. We had a day at a time put in the vows before that death do you part stuff. And my parents and my sisters came out for the wedding. My dad looked at all of you, and by the end of the day, my father said to me, "Sharon, you've got it made. Look at your life today." And my dad was giving me that approval that I craved so badly. But something had happened in those 2 years. Something had happened. I had my own. I had a lot of my own approval. And it was just icing on the cake when he told me that, because I knew I was overpaid. I knew that day. And we said about being married and having a good life, and, you know, he'd be general service, and I'd go to general service, and we did meetings together, and we would share pitches, and we were joined at the hip. And my sponsor right about that time had caught me after a Thursday night meeting outside, and she said, "Sharon, you better get your own guy, or you're going to get drunk." Because I was starting to get my rights back. You know how you get your rights back? I got my rights back. And I thought I had some answers. And she told me I better get my own God or I'm going to get drunk. And Beacon's Moving Van drove by that night. So I picked Beacon's. I was just there. I said, okay, Janet Beacons, that's my God. She said, fine, as long as it's not you. Fine with her. And so I prayed to Beacons for a long time. I was 2 years ago in Texas, and I didn't think I was going to make my flight back, and I wanted to get home. And he wasn't driving fast enough. You know, my host just wasn't driving fast enough to the airport, and the traffic was bad. And I just had to get on that flight, and I'm frothing at the mouth, and I'm trying to move the car faster, and I'm just ready to come apart, you know. I looked over, and there was a Beacons right there next to us. And I just kind of took a deep breath, you know. I made the flight. It was fine. And my son now, you know, Dick gave me a couple of Beacons trucks when I was in Iowa, and so he kind of knows a little bit about Beacons, and he points them out now when we're on the road. Look, Mom, there's the Beacons. And he doesn't know much about it other than it reminds me of God. So he points out Beacons for me, and it still works. I was lost just about a month ago in 2 Freeway in Los Angeles. I didn't even know there was one. And we were out of gas, and it was Monday night, and everything was dark, and we drove right off this off-ramp to where they all go to rest, all the Beacons fans, all go to sleep. They were all there. I just knew we were going to be all right. It was just okay. So I prayed to Beacons for a long time, and it still works, as long as it's not me. As long as my God is not me, it still works. About 5 years of sobriety, we started to have some problems, me and my husband. He became a punk rocker, and I had a good Al-Anon, and I had to learn to release him, and it was tough in the household for a while. It was very tough in the household, but the marriage hung in there, and he came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and life got real good. It got real good, and I found myself pregnant, which I thought I couldn't do, and I thought I didn't want to do. And June 23rd, 1984, my son Wesley was born. And I knew there was a God that day because he's got all his fingers and all his toes. And life was real good. Then he left. I was 10 years sober. I starting to speak a lot of places. I was sponsoring a lot of people, and I was a mother, and life was just terrific. And he walked out on me. This man just up and walked out on me. And it just didn't seem right to hang on his leg. It just didn't seem right to just lie down and doormat it. Because I couldn't tell that newcomer I'm working with to feel good about herself and do positive things and hang on his leg and beg him not to leave. And I had to let him go. And that was new for me. Because, you know, I had a sponsor named Ginny for a long time. She was so wonderful for me. And she says, Sharon, you're like this woman that's just clutching this gift. Just clutching this precious secret of a gift. And one day, you trusted me enough to let me peel back your fingers and look in your hand and see what you were clutching so tightly. And I looked in your hand, and I saw a turd. But I looked at her and stood up straight, and I said, I know, Ginny, but it's my turd. Belongs to me. And in Alcoholics Anonymous and working the 12 steps and trying to be of service and give it away, I have learned how to loosen my grip. Because when I can loosen my grip, I get so much back, because God wants more for me than I want for myself, and I can learn why in retrospect. When I'm halfway through the swamp of alligators, I want to know why the hell I'm thrown in the swamp, so I'm going to get to the other end, because I'm a curious sort. I want to know why I was thrown in the swamp. And if I walk back to the beginning, I'm going to go halfway through the swamp again, so I might as well go the other half to the next end of the shore and keep on going. And I didn't know why he was taken out of my life. I didn't know that for the next year and a month, the pain that I was going to go through, the betrayal I felt, the victim that I became, just the deep hurt, because I marry for life. That's the way I am. There was another woman involved, and she was younger than me and newcomerish, you know, they seemed to look like they were doing well together, and I just absolutely couldn't stand it. And Clancy had become my sponsor in there because Ginny had gotten off a plane with 21 days instead of 21 years. And she's doing fine now. She's got 6 years. And I love her to death. But Clancy had to become my sponsor because he was out there ahead of me, staying young, staying active, and giving it away in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I watched him all these years. And he's gone. He's having a good time. And that's what I want. I drank and used for more. You know, and I want to stay sober for more. Because it's not over. It's not over at 5 years, you know? Not over at 10 years. It's not over at 15 years. It's not over at 30 years. It continues on. This is a program of healing and love and life. And Clancy was there at that meeting that Saturday night. I was going to baptism with my two cups of hot coffee because they looked too happy over in the corner. And nobody got custody of our meetings, and it was very painful. And he caught me halfway through. And he took the coffee out of my hands and put them on the table and took me squarely by the shoulders and looked me in the eyes and said, "Sharon, you will walk through this with dignity and grace so you can be an example for others." This example crap, I heard it, you know, I heard it. And so that night I kind of turned myself into him. I gave him the spare keys to my ex's car. I was going to drive it in the ocean. I told him I had been shoplifting at the Broadway waiting to get caught so that they'd call him from jail and they know how much pain I'm really in. You know, I was just kind of crazy. I told him I'd been driving my car very fast looking at that center divider. I told him I was in a lot of pain. And I went home that night, and at 4 in the morning I woke up scared like I did a lot that year. And I started to write. And I took another inventory. And I took responsibility for my own life again. And I hung up my black. And I started working at having new choices instead of being a victim. And I started to realize that one finger points out at them, three fingers point back at me. And I better work on me if I want to stay sober. So I started to do that, and I went out and I got a job. And the people in Alcoholics Anonymous drove me to interviews and took care of me. And they supported me, and they gave me their love. And they were there for me, and they didn't let me sit at home and pull the covers. And I started to get better. And I didn't know I was getting better because I was on the move so much. And I was sitting in the St. Augustine's Church on actually, it was Ash Wednesday, and I was waiting for the nun I sponsor. I've made my amends to the Catholic Church, as I have. And I love Sheila. I love her a lot. I get to tell her to have faith. Don't worry, Sheila, have faith. She's such a dear support to me, and I was waiting for her that day, and it was a year and a month after my ex had walked out of my life. And I was sitting there quiet in God's house, and I felt the healing happen. I felt that tip of my head, the tip of my toes, fullness of spirit again, and I knew that I was through the next door. And I realized I had been in the hallway. You know, if you close the door in reality, it comes in the window. It really does. And I had been in that hallway for a year. And I looked back and I thought there were other people there with me. There were other people that were having problems that year. I was so self-absorbed and so self-motivated and our little plans. You know, I had all of that going like this, that I had been in that hallway for a year and a month with other people who had been in that hallway. And I've realized now that that's what life is about. It's just a series of hallways. One door closes, the other door opens. It always does in Alcoholics Anonymous. But it doesn't open always on my timing. You know, I drank tequila because it was my timing, you know, and one door closes, the other one better open today, you know, and it doesn't always do that. And I had the healing, and I began to really be able to walk on with my own life. And my own life today, you know, I am rocketed into the fourth dimension. I have had 4 years of just incredible closeness to a God who loves me so much, and that I know that, and that's the beauty of it. That I can take that with me wherever I go. I have been able to be a mother to that son. He's six now, and he's in first grade. And the other day they were reading A.A. Milne in school, the teacher, and Winnie the Pooh. And she said it was by A.A. Milne, and well, guess what? My son's little hand goes up, and he says, "I know AA, my mom's an AA." And he says, real proud, you know. And so she goes to meetings, and the teacher thought that was nice, and went and told the principal, who's one of us, and the principal called me to tell me this cute little story, and he's in that school, and he's being loved, and he's getting that million-dollar education, and he's feeling secure, and he's doing well, and a year ago, he was in another school, and he was hiding in the parking lot and not going to school in kindergarten, and he was labeled the bad kid, and he'd already become the bad seed, and I thought I had done something wrong. I'm gone too much. We're not having enough quality time. And the divorce has scarred him. And I didn't know. And I called a lot of friends in Alcoholics Anonymous who had raised children alone. And they told me, Sharon, my friend Ken D told me, he said, Sharon, you know, there was this plant I had. And I my ex-wife left it. And I really wanted to kill it. So it looked almost dead. So I moved it out in the patio because I didn't want to look at it anymore. And then one day my neighbor called me and said, you know what, your plant is growing up into my vines. And he said, sometimes you just have to change their environment. Well, that's wisdom. So I asked, after he was asked to leave that school, I thought, change the environment. And I did. And he's flourishing. And he's healthy. And he's fun. And these things keep coming back at the end of Happy Birthday when we go sing Happy Birthday somewhere. And he wakes up happy in the morning. And he's just a joy to have. I am so grateful that I get to be his mom. He told me he was glad he chose me. I want to tell you about my relationship with my ex, because we are friends today. He walked into the marriage with that woman, and they have a baby now who's 2 years old, and I just it was a long process of letting go and healing, and I remember being in Clancy's backyard a couple years ago on the 4th of July, and I found myself over with them and their new baby, and I looked around, and, you know, we're taking pictures, and I'm holding their baby, and they're holding Wesley, and we're all there in the row with the same last name on these name tags, you know, and I thought, I kind of looked around, and I thought, you know, only in Alcoholics Anonymous, only with a program can this happen, and we're all, you know, we're just having this family 4th of July picnic, me and my stepwife, and my ex-husband, and all of them, you know, and I went to their child's birthday party, the first birthday party, and I was of service, and I was in the kitchen, and I was helping, and I was on the video, and we were taking the pictures, and only in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wished them well. I wished them well. And he has since had to walk away from that marriage and go on to something else. And guess who is the example of walking through it with dignity and grace for my ex-stepwife? Moi. And my ex has got a lot of things he's got to heal, and I hope he heals them, and he's starting to, and he just had 16 years of sobriety, and I'm so glad nobody had to drink through all of this, and he's a wonderful father to Wesley, a wonderful father. But I was able to walk away from that, free and clear, without any guilt, without any ties, without any reservations, and I have a man in my life today for 4 years who we respect, and we try to live by the premises that a mate is there to help you find God. Not to get something from, not to fill me up, to help me find God. And we respect and love one another. And that's so nice. Let me tell you about my dad. I had made my amends because I finally got to those steps and we got a little honest and I started making some amends. And Jenny had me about 5, 6 years of sobriety. She said, have you made financial amends to your dad yet? Well, how does she know? She said, it's time. Why don't you call him and ask him how much you owe him? So I picked up the phone, and I called him, and I thought he'd have to think about it for a couple days. Wrong. He gave me a figure, and I called her back, and I said, Jenny, I think it's too much. I didn't tell him that. She said, no, and, you know, call him back in a couple days and tell him that this is what you can do. And we discussed what I could do, and we made some sort of an arrangement of how much I can financially afford and that kind of thing. And I thought, okay, let him sleep on it for a couple days. And then when I call him back in a couple days, he's going to remember that I didn't go to Europe like the rest of the kids, that I paid for most of my own wedding. He never bought me a car. I took a lot. He never bought me a car. And maybe he'll change his mind. So I called him back in a couple days, and I told him I was going to send him so much a month. He said, fine. He said, fine. All right, well, I called Jenny back, and I said, well, he said, fine. And she said, well, make your envelopes, and without fail, in the first of the month, you send that check, because you're working a step of an Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're an example, so you do not be late with that check. She said, by the way, put a note about your life in there, what you're doing, just kind of a newsy little note. Well, you know, here we go again. They make you grow. When you're down and hurting, they make you grow, you know. This note about my life, he could care about my life. She said, put it in there anyway. So
So without fail, I sent my father this check and this little newsy note every month. And there were months I didn't want to send it. There were months I didn't know I had the money to send it. She said, send it anyway. You'll be taken care of. She said, he's probably putting it into a trust fund for you, and they'll give it back to you at the end of so many years, so just go ahead and send it. So, well, I'd send it off early for a couple of months there, you know. All he's getting is the end result of Alcoholics Anonymous, working a step of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for about 3 years, a little over 3 years, I did this. And he called me one Christmas season. It was between Christmas and New Year's. And he said, Merry Christmas, Sharon. You don't have to send me any more checks. And I got off light. I'll tell you, I got off light. But he said to me, he added, don't stop sending me your notes. It's like somebody took some scissors and cut loose of about 10 pounds off of each shoulder. Those big chips just kind of fell away. And I became happy, joyous, and free again in Alcoholics Anonymous. And another part of me healed. And me and my dad can tell each other we love each other and hug each other and spend time together. And that's only with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. I am definitely overpaid. I have a good job today. They respect and they love me. They care about me. They told me I'm an asset to their firm. I walk in here and I'm loved. My son says that he's glad he chose me. I have a man in my life who respects me. I have a God who loves me more than I love myself. I have all of you this weekend that we were able to share heart to heart. I am definitely overpaid. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Boy, I lived by that line from Janis for a lot of years. And I was a victim and dead when I got to you. And I was a mess. And you didn't care because you saw something worth saving, something I didn't see for a lot of years. And you loved me, and you gave me the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You told me I had to work them, but this is the gift. And if you're in here today, you've got the gift. Thank you, Iowa, for the homecoming. I love you.